Welcome to the Radio Free Space Hour on WDRT Viroqua. This is episode number 4 of Poems Aloud, a show exploring history, nature, politics, and possibilities with poetry, story, and song. I'm your host, Ben Prostein. For this episode, we will be on the commons, exploring this ancient institution of communal land and resource use that, despite centuries of assault, continues to exist, not only as a way of living for millions of people, but also as an ideal in the political imagination. We will stop by the commons of Mexico, sub-Saharan Africa, England, and Ireland, and we'll hear the poems, songs, and rhymes that defended the commons, from a couplet by John Ball in 1381 to the many poems against enclosure by John Clare nearly 5 centuries later. I began working on this episode nearly a year ago, and very pleased to finally share it with whoever may be listening. My personal introduction to the commons came 10 or so years ago through the essays of 2 poets, one by Gary Snyder, collected in The Practice of the Wild, looking at how the commons relates to bioregionalism, our sense of place in the local, the other by Kenneth Rexroth in the now out-of-print Communalism, From Its Origins to the 20th Century, a book published in the early 1970s with encyclopedia-like chapters on numerous attempts at communal living throughout history, from early Christians to the diggers to the Amana colonies of Iowa. But it was 2 years ago that my interest in the commons really began to take off, as a local political reading group here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, read Caliban and the Witch by Sylvia Federici, a book exploring how the origins of capitalism was accompanied not only by the dispossession of agrarian peasants, but also the persecution and burning of thousands of women for the crime of witchcraft. Federici will be quoted throughout this episode. My thanks go out to Evan Dvorak and the Cooley Socialist Reading Group for leading me on to the common trail. But what do we mean when we refer to the commons? Today, we may hear of the global commons, such as the climate, oceanic ecologies, and watersheds. We may also hear reference to information commons, public databases on the internet, like Wikipedia, for example. But how do these relate to the historic commons, as they've existed on every inhabited continent of the world? If we look to the Latin roots of the word communis, it suggests what is mutually held together. The family of words that branch out from the commons is a rich one, such as communion, community, communicate, commune, communal, common sense, and communism. A unique local example is about an hour's drive from where we are broadcasting in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. An unincorporated community near Gutenberg, Iowa, by the name of Communia. This was one community of many founded by German utopian socialists in the mid-19th century. This attempted commune included, at one point, Wilhelm Wettling, who was one of the notable socialist thinkers of the period, whose writings were praised and debated by other European radicals like Karl Marx and Bakunin. Communia failed, not even lasting 10 years, but its name survives on a road sign in Iowa. So, at the root of the commons and what is suggested in its branches of words is that which is reciprocal, mutual, and shared. Sylvia Federici offers the following definition of the commons that illuminates the broadness of the term today. Quote, lodged halfway between the public and the private, but irreducible to either category, the idea of the commons expresses a broader conception of property, referring to social goods, lands, territories, forests, meadows, and streams are communicative spaces that a community, not the state or any individual, collectively owns, manages, and controls. End quote. As Federici suggests, when we begin to view the history of various struggles through the framework of the commons, we observe a continuum, a commonality rather than difference and isolation. The resistance of Native Americans to European colonialism resembles the resistance of English peasants to the enclosures of England. The farmers fighting against the privatization of seed genetics complements the struggle for an information commons on the internet. We have more in common than we may think. The commons exists not only as a place, a noun, but a set of social relations and customs, what some refer to as commoning. Despite the enclosure of the commons, commoning survives. Commoning is the potluck, the shared work of raising children, preparing home meals, saving and swapping seeds, gathering in a group to discuss a book or politics. It's the urban squat in an abandoned building, community gardens, land reclamations in Africa and Latin America. It's those practices that predate and continue to resist the exploitations of market society, nation states, and transnational corporations. While an ideology of individualism and self-interest may hold sway on much of public discourse, where nearly everything is now viewed as something that can be owned and bought, commoning is the unseen work that keeps society from collapsing. It's the lowercase communism we enact every day, summed up by the 19th century motto, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. As Federici adds, commoning is an irreducible aspect of our life, one that no violence can destroy, as it is continually recreated as a necessity of our existence. A word that has already cropped up and will continue in our discussions of the commons is enclosure. The English word used to describe the privatization and expropriation of the commons. If the notion of the commons suggests that which a community mutually holds together and has a right to access, enclosure implies something that is walled off, gated, and whose access is limited. Through enclosure, the commons became physically enclosed through fences and hedges, and it became legally enclosed through laws protecting and ensuring private property. Enclosure continues today, not only in the holdouts of the common lands in Africa and Latin America, but in the sphere of research, information, and technology. Two examples come from agribusiness. Genetically modified seeds are declared intellectual property, and some new tractors by companies such as John Deere cannot be worked on or repaired or modified by the farmers who own them. I hope the sharp and sometimes fiery responses of commoners of the past will shed light on these new forms of enclosure. And we can see clearly and unambiguously that these are, in the words of the poet John Clare, lawless laws and the tyranny of accursed wealth. It may be useful to refer to a multitude of commons. In the face of climate change and ecological crisis, it's useful to imagine the climate, the oceans, watersheds, and soil as commons shared by all and whose degradation will, in turn, impact all, thus helping us realize individual responses may not be our salvation. But what is largely lost to us, especially in the U.S., is the commons as they've existed for most of history. A means of accessing subsistence, the means of survival outside of the total control of state and markets. The enclosure of the commons embodies what the historian Ivan Illich calls the 500-year war on subsistence. By those who advocated enclosure in England, the peasants who lived by the commons were compared in a negative light to Native Americans. They were considered barbarous, lazy, idle, were all terms of contempt for both English commoners and Native Americans. That renegade group of Protestants that colonized New England, the Puritans, would refer to the commons as great nurseries of idleness. At least in the case of the English commoners, laziness was a way of saying these workers were unavailable for further employment and wage work. They refused work because they could live without wages. The commons provided them with a means of subsistence. Of course, English commoners weren't really lazy. Through their rights to the commons, they milked cows, kept sheep, raised hogs and poultry, gardened, cleaned grain fields, gathered firewood and timber for tools, utensils, and shelters. They fished, hunted small game, and foraged for medicinal herbs and wild honey. But this was work, like that of indigenous nations in North America, that was performed for local subsistence, not commercial gain. By contrast, the wage work of early industrial England was brutal. Long days, nearly every day of the year, and what William Blake called the dark satanic mills. To Blake, the mills not only grinded flour, but also the imagination, desires, and bodies of the working class. The work of the Commons, however, followed a more seasonal pattern, at times busy, at other times slow and leisurely, with celebrations accompanying busy times of the year like shearing and fall harvest. Commoners often had a kind of free time and access to leisure we don't often assume to be a part of agrarian life or pre-industrial existence. And much of this has to do with the fact that it was agricultural production for necessity rather than profit. When wage work began to rise into prominence with the beginning of capitalism, there's a reason English commoners often referred to this form of work as wage slavery. They recognized how it was a loss of freedom, a way of life. Thus, the commoners of England often enter history through resistance, attacking hedges, pulling down fences, destroying enclosure notices penned to church doors, rioting, petitioning, arson, burning down fence posts under the pretext of a football match, and writing anonymous and threatening poems to those in power who enclosed the commons. The historian Jeanette Neeson writes that common field peasants shared a common culture. Their common rights supported customary behavior, joint agricultural practice, mutual aid, and on occasion, a sense of political solidarity. The commons may lead us to a sense of economy beyond the market and the state, but not necessarily. The borders are not exclusive. Commercial dairy farms in an alpine region of Switzerland continue to manage seasonal mountain pastures as commons, and some lobster fisheries off the coast of Maine, despite suburban commercial markets, have been managed in common as well. The state, in some rare instances, has enacted and ensured the rights to the commons too. Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution, drafted in 1917, recognized ejidos, communally held land that could not be bought or sold by their communal owners, nor individually titled. This, however, began to rapidly change in 1994 as ejidos became subjected to privatization under the administration of Carlos Salinas de Gortari, Mexico's Harvard-educated president. The subsequent uprising and land reclamations of the Zapatistas of Chiapas was a resistance not only to the repeal of Article 27, but also the recently drafted North American Free Trade Agreement, better known as NAFTA, and currently under revision by U.S. Congress and the Trump administration. After the passing of NAFTA, the cheap U.S.-subsidized corn that flooded Mexico markets would also disrupt the land tenure of Mexican farmers. Subcomandante Moises of the Zapatistas says this, quote, "The capitalists want to take, to extract, to destroy what took Mother Earth billions of years to make. How can that be? Well, just remember the trick of the capitalist system, the trap that it set when they changed Article 27 so that the ejidos could be privatized. Because what they're trying to do now is make Mother Earth something that can be bought and sold." End quote. But what about the so-called tragedy of the commons, the popular theory posited by biologist Garrett Hardin in 1968? The basic argument of Hardin's is common pool resources that are unknown are unprotected and thus open to extensive exploitation. The theoretical example involved pasture, where everyone who owned cattle had access to the commons would try to maximize their gain, putting too many cows on the land and overgrazing the pasture, resulting in the end in ecological degradation. This example has some truth to it, but that truth is more typical with commercial cattle production on public and private land, not necessarily the commons. The theory is just that, a theory. It has been challenged and criticized by sociologists, historians, anthropologists, economists, and perhaps most importantly, the living examples of communal land use that persist today. As the poet and essayist Gary Snyder writes, "When Hardin et al. Try to apply their model to the historic commons, it doesn't work, because they fail to note that the commons was a social institution, which, historically, was never without rules and did not allow unlimited access." Hardin views the commons through the logic of Western market societies, emphasizing individual self-interest rather than the historic reality of mutual aid and cooperation. In the history of the commons in England, we observe cooperation and collective regulation, not unbridled self-interest. In some villages, bylaws would be established in the spring and autumn, determining pasture and field use. There would also be fines for overstocking pastures, suggesting ecological community stewardship rather than extractive exploitation like Hardin theorized. Hardin applies the logic of 20th century market economics to subsistence ecology, believing people will act on self-interest and exploit a common resource. Hardin would sum up his thinking by vaguely saying, with dystopia-like implications, quote, freedom in a common brings ruin to all, and injustice is preferable to total ruin, end quote. We can, however, observe local communities through customs and practices ecologically sustaining the commons by fitting the land to ecologically appropriate uses and observing the carrying capacity in regards to the number of animals grazed on the land. The real tragedy of the commons is how they've been enclosed and destroyed through warfare, colonialism, and economic policy. Going deeper into the story of the commons and enclosure in England, we'll begin near the end of the 14th century, just a little over 600 years ago. The story of the commons and their enclosure in England is a crooked one. The privatization of the commons happened slowly, over half a millennia, and with many pauses. In the 13th century creation of the Magna Carta and the lesser known but equally significant Charter of the Forest, we can observe attempts on the part of commoners to preserve their right to the commons of the forest for the purposes of gathering wild firewood, wild honey, and raising livestock. A verse describing early Christian communities that would influence centuries of English commoners came from the Book of Acts. In a contemporary translation, the verse reads, "All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all, as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts." Later, in the same chapter, the author would add, "Now, the whole group of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and no one claimed private ownership of any possessions, but everything they owned was held in common." The biblical ideal of all things held in common would persist into the Industrial Age, where the poet William Blake would say, "The whole business of man is the arts and all things common." The image of communalism as described in the Bible would become a rallying point for generations of English peasants resisting the attempts to seize their common lands and rights of subsistence. The entirety of the Bible, however, would not be translated into English until the 14th century. Mass, by decree of the Roman Catholic Church, was still given in Latin. John Ball, the eccentric Loward preacher, went against this custom and preached to the peasants in English. He traveled around as a kind of roving preacher, advocating social equality and all things in common, and denouncing the exploitative actions of lords, judges, and lawyers. For this, he was imprisoned multiple times and eventually excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. John Ball is sometimes cited, along with Wat Tyler, as one of the leaders of the Peasant Revolt of 1381. But Ball's involvement may be somewhat overemphasized. John Ball is most remembered for a couplet, that is, a two-line poem that looked again to the Bible for a vision of society beyond class and hierarchy. Here it is in its entirety. "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" Gentleman in Ball's poem represented the nobility, the upper crust. He was referring more generally to the hierarchy of church, monarchy, and aristocracy. Ball would be freed from prison during the Peasant Revolt and would join thousands of others in petitioning before the King of England. The key demands before the king were the abolishment of serfdom, the ends of oppressive taxes that were utilized to fund wars against France, and the reestablishment of rights to the commons. During the Peasant Revolt, Ball began an open-air sermon with his two-line poem and then offered the following as a kind of interpretation. Quote, "From the beginning, all men by nature were created alike, and our bondage or servitude came in by the unjust oppression of naughty men. For if God would have had any bondmen from the beginning, he would have appointed who should be bond and who be free. And therefore, I exhort you to consider that now the time has come, appointed to us by God, in which ye may, if ye will, cast off the yoke of bondage and recover liberty." End quote. So one of the earliest articulations of class revolt was coming from a radical interpretation of Christianity, found right in the Bible, but hidden in the clerical use of the Latin language. Ball's little poem makes another critique. With Adam and Eve, the labor of reproducing life is performed, unlike the gentleman who benefits solely from the labor of others. As Ball would say in an earlier sermon, "From us must come, from our labor, the things which keep them in luxury." The peasants' revolt of 1381, however, was a failure, and Ball would be brutally executed for his involvement. He received the punishment of treason. He was hanged, drawn, and quartered. But what we observe again and again in the history of class struggle in England and in the defense of all things in common is how these failures sow the seeds of future dissent. Ball's little poem would be reprinted for centuries to come. We can find it in the literary work of the English socialist William Morris, in A Dream of John Ball, and in the poetry of the American Thomas McGrath in the second half of the 20th century, in his book-length poem, Letter to an Imaginary Friend. Nearly three centuries later, during the English Revolution, the commons were still being imagined and defended through a radical interpretation of Christianity, but now in the context of Protestantism. One of the more radical factions of the English Revolution in the mid-17th century was a group that referred to themselves as the True Levellers, but are more commonly remembered as the name given to them by their critics, the Diggers. In the spring of 1649, the Diggers occupied a former tract of common land on St. George Hill and published their manifesto, authored by Gerard Winstanley, The True Levellers' Standard Advanced. Winstanley explained the purpose of their commune. "The work we are going about is this, to dig up George's Hill and the waste ground thereabouts, and to sow corn, and to eat our bread together by the sweat of our brows." Speaking out against the enclosures of common lands, Winstanley added that they intended to make the earth a common treasury. The squat was short-lived and the Diggers were soon evicted. Other attempts at occupying lands and forming a community where all things were held in common would be attempted, but the movement was short-lived. By all accounts, the Diggers' attempt at what some have referred to as a kind of proto-communist society was a failure, but their philosophy, surviving in the writings of Winstanley, would prove fruitful. The Diggers are seen by many as the forerunners of socialist and anarchist philosophy. Like Ball, the seeds of the Diggers entered the soil bank of dissent, arising again, sometimes centuries later, when the conditions were ripe for germination. In the writings of Winstanley, we can hear echoes of John Ball. Like Ball, Winstanley denounced the exploitation of lawyers, judges, and the ruling class, and repeatedly looked to the Bible for his vision of a true commonwealth. He looked to the beginning of time, where the earth was a common treasury. To Winstanley, not one word was spoken in the beginning that one branch of mankind should rule over another. In his tract entitled A Declaration from the Poor Oppressed People of England, Winstanley would say, "The power of enclosing land and owning property was brought into the creation by your ancestors by the sword, which first did murder their fellow creatures, men, and after plunder or steal away their land." One of the key points in Winstanley's thinking is that private property, the power of enclosing land, comes into being by violence, what Winstanley would repeatedly call the sword. Winstanley's sword and its means of establishing and maintaining power is the precursor to the mantra of our own period, that war is the health of the state. Winstanley continues, quote, "The power of the murdering and thieving sword, formerly as well as now of late, hath set up a government and maintains that government. For what are prisoners and putting others to death but the power of the sword to enforce people to that government which was got by conquest and sword, and cannot stand of itself but by the same murdering power?" As we'll get to later, Winstanley's critique cut a wide swath, integrating private property, incarceration, warfare, and capital punishment. As Ball would say, "From us must come, from our labor, the things which keep them in luxury." Winstanley would add, quote, "All rich men live at ease, feeding and clothing themselves by the labor of other men and not by their own, which is their shame and not their nobility, for it is a more blessed thing to give than to receive. Centuries before Marx, Winstanley was making a distinction between who owns the means of production and who performs it, who owns capital and who labors under its demands. The Digger's Song is often attributed to Gerard Winstanley. Whether or not he wrote it, his ideas clearly shine forth in its lyrics. Here is the British band Chumbawamba performing the Digger's Song off their album English Rebel Songs, 1381 to 1984.
You noble diggers all, stand up now, stand up now. You noble diggers all, stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name. Your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now. Your houses they pull down to fright your men in town. But the gentry must come down and the poor shall wear the crown. Stand up now, diggers all. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, stand up now. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold. Stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, stand up now. The gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found. Their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise. The devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Gainst lawyers and gainst priests, stand up now, stand up now. Gainst lawyers and gainst priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath. To grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth. Stand up now, diggers all. The club is all their law, stand up now, stand up now. The club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe. But they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
You are listening to 91.9 WDRT Viroqua. That was the British band Chumbawamba performing the Digger's Song. In that song, we can hear lawyers, clergy, the ruling classes, all singled out as the propagators of enclosure and of, in Winstanley's words, cheating the poor of their ground. If Winstanley was critical of clergy and law, at least as they tended to function within English society, his writings were often directed to them as a plea for reform and justice. But in one of his finer statements, he directs his appeal towards a kind of ecological justice. Quote, "If neither minister nor lawyer will undertake a reconciliation of this case for the beauty of our commonwealth, then we appeal to the stones, timber, and dust of the earth you tread upon, to hold forth the light of this business. Questioning not, but that power that dwells everywhere will cause light to spring out of darkness and freedom out of bondage. In criticisms of the enclosure of the commons, we often hear criticisms of the system of law. Enclosing the commons and turning them into private property was justified and defended through legal statutes. New laws supplanted the customs of the commons. 5 centuries exist between the preacher John Ball and the poet John Clare, but we find the same denunciation of what Clare would call the lawless laws of enclosure. As U.S. farmers protesting foreclosure during the Great Depression would realize, law and justice are not always the same thing. Foreclosure may happen through the auspices of law, but it doesn't mean it's serving any real sense of justice. An anonymous folk poem from the 17th century and 2 rhyming couplets describes the hypocrisy of the legal system as it relates to the commons. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose, who steals the common from the goose. The poem clearly says it. Enclosure was an act of theft, robbing the English commoners of their means of subsistence and way of life. The poem tells us who the law punishes, essentially the poor, and who the law serves, the powerful. The men and women who steal the goose from off the common for the purpose of survival are imprisoned, while those who steal the commons are let loose and enriched through ownership of private land and resources. Legal systems assisted in transforming the commons into private property, supplanting the previous system of local customs, kinship, and community cooperation. The poem clearly depicts the multiple contradictions of law. Enclosure robbed the English peasantry of the means of subsistence and then enclosed them in prison for desperate acts committed on the behalf of subsistence, such as stealing bread or, as the poem puts it, a goose. Of course, what the poem calls the greater villain, the ones who steal the commons through violence, law, and economic self-interest, is still loose today. The land policies of the World Bank that encloses land in Africa and Latin America, the financial bailout of 2008, where the financier class of the U.S. was let loose to begin their plunder again, are in the current debate of nation states over the resources of Greenland becoming accessible through the disasters of global warming. And there is an ecological thread to this folk rhyme as well. The goose itself is dispossessed of the commons, robbed of its habitat. As we learn most vividly in the poetry of John Clare, enclosure often meant a transformation of the landscape. Meadows were plowed, fens drained, forests cut for timber. Enclosure then not only dispossessed the English commoners, but also the birds, flowers, trees that inhabited the landscape of the commons. It was not only a social and political transformation, but an ecological one, too. The privatization of the commons, which would occur over 5 centuries in England, was accompanied by the rise of prisons, police forces, and criminal codes to protect private property. Gerard Winstanley would say, "The idea of mine and thine has brought in all misery upon people. For first, it hath occasioned people to steal from one another. Secondly, it hath made laws to hang those that did steal. It tempts people to do an evil action and then kills them for doing it." End quote. Winstanley observed how enclosure, by dispossessing the poor of a means of subsistence, encouraged crime. 200 years before the French anarchist Proudhon, Winstanley would say the same thing: property is theft. His comments prove as insightful to the crisis of mass incarceration in the U.S. today as they were to the social chaos of 17th century England, how society punishes its citizens for crimes that society tempts citizens to commit. As Peter Linebaugh tells us, the loss of the commons often enters the historical archives as crime. There is a correlation in England between the enclosure of land and the enclosure of bodies in prison. As land became increasingly privatized over England, we observe a correlated rise in the number of prisons, executions, and laws against vagabonds and prostitution. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater villain loose, who steals the common from the goose. As we move into the world after the American and French revolutions and the beginning of industrialization, we can find an idea of the commons in the poetry of the English and American romantics. William Wordsworth would refer to the common wind in his poem celebrating the Haiti Revolution. Later, Walt Whitman in America would refer to the language of his poetry as the common air that bathes the globe. This, however, is more the common as ideal, the commons of the creative imagination, rather than the commons of practice and subsistence. But there is one English poet who not only experienced the old customs of the commons in his native village of Helpstone, but also their enclosure in the early 19th century by Act of Parliament. This is John Clare. Clare was born in 1793 to English farm laborers. His father was semi-literate, his mother illiterate, and Clare's formal education was minimal. Yet he took to poetry and read what books he could get his hands on. His mother began saving pieces of paper that would have been used for kindling so her son could write poems. Clare, who performed a variety of farm jobs, preferred field work to gardening because he could slip away, hidden by a bush or dike, and write upon the brim of his hats. On Sundays, he would go to the woods or common and revise his notes jotted in fragments throughout the work week. As Clare said, he would forsake the church-going bell and seek the religion of the fields. In his own life and in the criticism that followed after his death, Clare often suffered under the label of peasant poet. But this was, in many ways, a nostalgic classification. By the time Clare began publishing in the 1820s, the peasantry, as a social class in England, no longer really existed. The intensified period of enclosure between 1750 and 1820, initiated by acts of the British Parliament, was the final blow to the English peasantry, or at least its transformation. The peasantry would then exist as wage workers, factory workers, the industrial working class, the urban poor, vagabonds, in one word, the dispossessed. As Raymond and Mary Williams say in an essay on Clare, quote, "The real economy of rural England, through a long period of enclosures and engrossings, had become a complex structure of landlords, tenants, and landless laborers. Moreover, and just as important in its effects, the decisive economic structure of English society as a whole was coming to be based in mercantile capital and the money market." The peasantry was not only undergoing a transformation as capitalism succeeded feudalism, literature too was being transformed by the emerging market society. The system of patronage, where artists could be financially supported by patrons of the upper class, was giving way to the literary market. So, as a farm laborer or a so-called peasant, Clare struggled to find a reliable livelihood in the country. The commons were enclosed. To make a living meant wage work, not subsistence. To gain a livelihood as a writer was less dependent on the welfare of patrons and increasingly dependent on the number of sales a publication could fetch. The changing social relations of both the fine arts and the practical arts of literature and agriculture are embodied in the life of John Clare. Nearly all the poems we'll be hearing from Clare today were not published in his lifetime. His urban publishers wanted, as the title of his first collection of poems tell us, poems descriptive of rural life and scenery. That is, poems giving a kind of romantic sense of the peasantry, earthiness, simplicity, natural images, not the poetry of an exploited and nearly extinguished class. Clare would often, in the same poem, give them both. But his socially and politically infused poems denouncing enclosure and the power of the upper classes would not be published until the 20th century. It didn't fit into the image his publishers had of a peasant poet. In this section from Remembrances, Clare speaks to the transformation of the landscape brought on by enclosure. "By Langley Bush I roam, but the bush hath left its hill. On copper green I stray, 'tis a desert strange and chill, and spreading lay close oak ere decay had penned its will to the axe of the spoiler, and self-interest fell a prey. And cross berry way, an old round oak's narrow lane, with its hollow trees like pulpits, I shall never see again. Enclosure, like a Bonaparte, let not a thing remain. It leveled every bush and tree, and leveled every hill, and hung the moles for traitors. Though the brook is running still, it runs a naked brook, cold and chill. In 1809, when Clare was 16, Parliament passed an act enclosing his native village of Helpstone. What was once an open world of pastures, fens, streams, woods, and fields was now fenced in private property. The period of 1750 to 1820, when Parliament passed numerous acts enclosing the Commons of England, is often referred to as the final blow to the peasants of Common Field England. A third of England's agricultural land would be enclosed in this period. In the original manuscripts of Clare's poetry and prose, punctuation is noticeably scarce and sometimes absent. His publishers, who sometimes attributed this to Clare's minimal education, often added punctuation and corrected his grammar. But Clare's lack of punctuation was a conscious choice. He would tell one editor he wrote to be generally understood and referred to punctuation as an awkward squad of pointings. He also compared punctuation to tyrannical governments, such as Bonaparte that he mentioned in the poem we read from earlier. Like the commons that Clare worked, traveled, and enjoyed in his youth, he wanted his language to be open, not enclosed by grammatical symbols of division, the fences of punctuation. Just like a landscape, you have to walk it to get a real feel for it, to feel out the breaks and pauses of Clare's poetry. As Clare entered his middle years, he would struggle with poverty, depression, and hallucinations. The last 24 years of his life would be confined to the Northampton General Lunatic Asylum. Clare's poem, The Moors, is one of many that begins with a natural scene that is then intruded by the forces of enclosure. Far spread the moory ground, a level scene, bespread with rush and one eternal green, that never felt the rage of blundering plow, though centuries wreathed spring blossoms on its brow. Still meeting plains that stretched them far away, in unchecked shadows of green, brown, and gray, unbounded freedom ruled the wandering scene, nor fence of ownership crept in between to hide the prospect of the following eye. Its only bondage was the circling sky. One mighty flat, undwarfed by bush and tree, spread its faint shadow of immensity and lost itself, which seemed to eke its bonds in the blue mist the horizon's edge surrounds. Now this sweet vision of my boyish hours, free as spring clouds and wild as summer flowers, is faded all, a hope that blossomed free and hath been once, no more shall ever be. Enclosure came and trampled on the grave of labor's rights and left the poor a slave. And memory's pride, ere want to wealth did bow, is both the shadow and the substance now. The poem continues and then ends. But paths to freedom and to childhood dear, a board sticks up to notice no road here, and on the tree with ivy overhung, the hated sign by vulgar taste is hung, as though the very birds should learn to know when they go there they must no further go. Thus, with the poor, scared freedom bade goodbye, and much they feel it in the smothered sigh, and birds and trees and flowers without a name all sighed when lawless law's enclosure came. And dreams of plunder in such rebel schemes have found true truly that they were but dreams. The closing lines of this poem are worth commenting on. Dreams of plunder in such rebel schemes have found true truly they were but dreams. Clare may be reminding us that the dreams of plunder, the economic self-interest that is at the root of enclosure, begins as just that, a dream, an idea. Unlike his contemporary, Percy Shelley, who would advocate the masses rise like lions after slumber, Clare gives no call to revolt or uprising. But what's implied in these last lines that the lawless laws of enclosure are a dream we can wake up from? The world can still be changed. Clare's numerous elegies for the specific landscapes that were transformed by enclosure are a means to tell us what was lost, a means to tell us of a world where things are held in common rather than privately owned, the possibility of a world where cows, bugs, flowers, grass, elms, streams, birds, and people live in a community, a kind of mutuality. Karl Marx would later lament that the very memory of the agricultural labor and the communal property had vanished. Clare, however, remembered. Enclosure to Clare is an obliteration. Everything has changed for workers, plants, trees, and animals, lovers wandering the path of the commons. As Clare writes, these are all destroyed. In Clare's poem, the little paths that little flowers are replaced by little parcels and little mines. Enclosure, then, was the end of a certain way of life. The path stopped. A certain way of existing was closed off from the industrializing world. Whether it's the postmodern claim to the end of history or Margaret Thatcher's neoliberal mantra that there is no alternative, we are still dealing with the enclosure of not just the physical world, but the imagination, too. As Clare would write, in little parcels, little minds to please. Clare lived in what he wrote. He was a native to the world he lived in. Nature, the country, is not a means to extract symbols and decorations for literature, but a place to be inhabited, a place of subsistence for human and non-human life. When Clare laments the degradation of landscape by early forms of agribusiness, he does not speak in the abstract, but to specific places, Round Oak Waters, Swarty Well, Helpstone Green. John Keats, the more famous of Clare's contemporary poets, criticized Clare for providing too many images and not connecting them to a higher philosophy. Clare would respond that Keats describes nature as it appeared in his fancy, not as he would have described nature had he witnessed the things he describes. There has been a revived interest in the poetry of Clare over the last 30 or 40 years. Once understood as a kind of minor English romantic overshadowed by Keats, Wordsworth, Shelley, Lord Byron, he is now seen by many as a major English poet of the 19th century. Clare's inclination towards images, landscape, direct statement, and experiments in punctuation no doubt makes him more receptive to the contemporary reader. But the revived interest in Clare also relates to his poems denouncing the enclosure of the commons. Clare was the eulogist to the loss of the commons, and his poetry gives us both a glimpse into this older world of custom and communal land use, and the outrage experienced by the dispossessed peasantry, an outrage that has been experienced by indigenous peoples removed from their homelands all over the world. Clare may have been a radical in the basic definition of that word. He went to the root of enclosure, and he saw clearly that, in his words, the prosperity of one class was founded on the adversity and distress of the other. It's intriguing how much of Clare's views on enclosure would resonate with the work of Karl Marx nearly half a century later. Marx, called the poet of the commodity by Edmund Wilson, devoted the last chapter of Capital to the enclosure of the commons in England. When Marx was making his diagnosis of capitalism in the second half of the 19th century, he recognized how this modern system, based on wages, surplus value, and capital, didn't just come out of nowhere. And he referred to this as the secret of primitive accumulation, or what could be more accurately translated as primary accumulation. This included the enclosure of the commons, the divorce of peasants from their means of subsistence, the lords of feudalism succeeded by the landlords of capitalism. Land becomes connected to the production of commodities rather than a culture and community of subsistence. And without access to land, the former peasants are forced to depend on wage work. And to Marx, this is the beginning of the industrial proletariat. With Marx, the history of enclosure was written in the annals of mankind in letters of blood and fire. That is, it was a transformation often accompanied by violence. European peasants did not give up the commons without a fight, and their revolts were often violently suppressed. In Marx's own words, quote, "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of conquest and lootings of the East Indians, the churning of Africa into a warren for the commercial huntings of black skins, signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief momentum of primitive accumulation." As Silvia Federici argues in Caliban and the Witch, her book revising and expanding that of Marx's on primary accumulation, the enclosures of the commons was also accompanied by the persecution and burning of thousands of women for the so-called crime of witchcraft. The women charged with witchcraft were often widows, elderly or single poor women, and their accusers were often landlords and employers. In the customs of the commons, elderly women were often guaranteed a kind of feudal version of social security, access to firewood and grains, for example. Witchcraft or magic was often seen as a threat to a worldview increasingly based on rationality and mechanization. This is the period when the philosopher Descartes would write, "I think, therefore I am," divorcing the mind from the body. As Federici writes, the world had to be disenchanted in order to be dominated. Federici examines enclosure and the advent of capitalism in Europe from a feminist perspective, looking at how these social and economic transformations redefine the place of women in society. With the rise of wage work, production for markets would take on a new heightened value. The work of reproduction, that is, raising children, keeping house, growing and cooking food, work mostly performed by women, would now be devalued. This would become the shadow work of industrial society, work necessary for the continuity of the working class. But existing outside of market society and yet necessary for the survival of society as whole, domestic work often became non-work. It was not given the kind of value that wages, surplus, and profit were given. We'll hear one more poem by John Clare, perhaps his most popular, "I Am." As mentioned earlier, Clare spent the final years of his life in an asylum. He continued to write poems, often with incredible lucidity, and this is one of them. This poem speaks to a profound sense of alienation. Alienation from love, land, memory, self. Clare uses the word strange, and he means it in its older sense, of estrangement, of being torn apart or alienated. It is an early poem of a kind of self-estrangement that has become typical in English and American poetry in the many decades since. Like many English romantics, Clare wrote of childhood and the loss of innocence. But with Clare, enclosure added another dimension to this. The land he knew as a child was privatized and no longer accessible. And not only that, it was profoundly changed from the diverse landscape of the commons to one serving external markets. Here is the poem in its entirety. "I am, yet what I am none cares or knows. My friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. They rise and vanish in oblivious host, like shadows in love's frenzied, stifled throes. And yet I am and live, but like vapors tossed into the nothingness of scorn and noise, into the living sea of waking dreams, where there is neither sense of life or joys, but the vast shipwreck of my life's esteems. Even the dearest that I love the best are strange, nay, rather stranger than the rest. I long for scenes where man hath never trod, a place where woman never smiled or wept, there to abide with my Creator, God, and sleep as I in childhood sweetly slept, untroubling and untroubled where I lie, the grass below, above the vaulted sky. That was John Clare's poem, I Am, and we can see that he ends that poem by returning once again to an image that we saw in his earlier poems on the commons, the grass and the round sky. This episode has dealt with the multi-century enclosure of the commons, mostly in the British Isles. In the contemporary period, Africa and Latin America are two of the main holdouts of common land use and management. The commons persist, but not without resistance. In the case of Africa, specifically, the World Bank has sought to privatize the commons through structural adjustment plans, and some nation-states have subjected immense amounts of land to privatization. For many subsistence farmers in Africa, titling land is too expensive. Since women are the farmers of Africa, producing 80% of the continent's food, they, like the women of peasant Europe, often suffer the most from the loss of the commons. Nonetheless, new forms of commoning arise out of the crisis, such as urban gardens, land reclamations, and communal kitchens, campus greens utilized for grazing. The commons are the customs that accompany them remain irreducible aspects of life. The last word here will go to Gary Snyder from his essay on the commons, collected in the practice of the wild. The challenge is to bring the whole victimized world of common pool resources into the mind of the common. As it stands now, any resource on earth that is not nailed down will be seen as fair game to the timber buyers or petroleum geologists from Osaka, Rotterdam, or Boston. The pressures of growing populations and the powers of entrenched but fragile, confused, and essentially leaderless economic systems warp the likelihood of any of us seeing clearly. Our perception of how entrenched they are may also be something of a delusion. Sometimes it seems unlikely that a society as a whole can make wise choices. Yet there is no choice but to call for the recovery of the commons. And this in a modern world which doesn't quite realize what it has lost. That was John Fahey's How Long. And that will do it for our episode today. You've been listening to the Radio Free Space Hour on WDRT Viroqua. This has been Poems Aloud, and I've been your host, Ben Prostein. Thank you for listening.